Okay, so I guess we can start tonight's talk. I just came back from Europe a few days ago, so I feel still a little bit tired from the jet lag and that sort of stuff. And that reminded me earlier on today, it reminded me of a story that Ajahn Brahm tells from Thailand. This story is about this monk who was giving a talk, just like basically probably like what I'm doing here tonight. And he was giving a talk, and while he was giving a talk, he was so tired that in the middle of the talk, he fell asleep. Imagine being so relaxed when you give a talk that you fall asleep while giving the talk. That's pretty remarkable. And then he sort of nodded off, and he fell asleep for about 20 minutes. And then he came back to again, and he continued his talk afterwards. That's how they do things in Thailand. That's when you really relaxed. So if I fall asleep, just give me a bit of a... I'm just kidding. I'm just joking. I'm not going to fall asleep. Okay, so tonight's talk is going to be about devotion, and if there is such a thing as devotion in Buddhism, whether that's an important part of the practice or not. And what the thing that actually started this off, and the reason why I want to talk about this, is an email I received a while ago, and it's a man, I think it's a man, maybe it was a woman, not sure what gender it was, doesn't really matter. This person in Turkey was telling me about their Buddhist practice, and they were saying that before they became a Buddhist, they've been practicing some kind of Hindu practice. And Hindu, of course, often is also based on meditation. But what this person said was that when they were doing this Hindu practice, an important part of that was what they call devotional practice. You are devoted to God, right? This idea of Brahma, of God, is a very important part of the Hindu philosophy, Hindu ideas. And he or she said that because of that devotion to this supreme being, this kind of amazing thing, whatever it is, because of that, they were able to get a lot of joy and happiness in the meditation practice. And they said that later on they became a bit disillusioned with the philosophy of the Hindu system. They weren't really happy with that. So they moved on to Buddhism instead and became a Buddhist. But they said that when they became a Buddhist, they lacked that kind of happiness and joy that came from the devotion in the Hindu system. So they are asking me, well, is there anything similar in Buddhism, any kind of devotion that we should be doing to give that kind of joy and happiness, that extra oomph perhaps to the meditation practice that otherwise you might not get? And I thought it was a very, very important question, a very, very good question. Because I know that many Buddhists, they often practice in a kind of very dry way. You know, right? You have this idea of some sort of dry meditation practice. And often it can feel very dry. It feels like, becomes like an intellectual pursuit or a pursuit of insight, but no emotion behind it. No kind of, not that joy, which actually should be very much part of the Buddhist practice. Later on, I was also asked for somebody else, what about the heart quality in meditation practice and Buddhist practice? Isn't that important? And of course, it is very important. So this is what I want to talk about from a Buddhist perspective. But first of all, the idea of a god and having devotion to a god, like you might do in Hinduism, or perhaps in Christianity and also other religions, the first question is, for me, is always, is that such a good idea? It may give rise to joy, to happiness, but does it really work? Is it a sound basis for that joy and happiness? What are you actually devoted to when you are devoted to a god? And, of course, what you are devoted to is basically you have your own ideas of what this god is, right? You think that God is love, God created the universe, very powerful being, this god, whatever it is. But, of course, this is just your own creation, right? You don't really know exactly what it is. You've heard a few stories from here and there. You hear about things, but you're not really certain what it actually means. So it's uncertain very often. And if you look at the history of the idea of God, there was a book written a few years ago called The History of God by a scholar called Karen Armstrong that was very interesting. And it was about the evolution of the idea of God within Christianity. And it showed you how God, the idea of God, starts off in the Old Testament, right? It's a very kind of a personal God. It's a God which is just above you, basically, always watching over you and punishing you when you do something bad and kind of rewarding you when you do something good. And this was the personal God of the Jewish people of Israel, very, very close to you, almost human in a sense, in its emotions and in its way of interacting with the world. And then over the years, the idea of God changed, right? Gradually it changes. And it changes and changes. It becomes less and less personal over time. This was one of the arguments that she was making in this book. And eventually, today, if you ask most Christians today what God is, God is kind of this very abstract thing. It's very hard to pinpoint. God is just love or something like that, something very abstract. So the idea of God has evolved enormously, you know, throughout, certainly within Christianity, probably also in other religions. It has evolved. So which one of these gods do we believe in? Which God is actually our God? And many people will have very different ideas of what sort of God is their God. For some people, God is very personal and very interactive. For others, it's something very abstract and far away. So that is a second way. Still, great uncertainty about what God is, right? It's very hard to pinpoint anything very clearly here. And the third way that people often talk about God is the idea of personal experience. You have some idea, some experience in meditation practice, perhaps, or some other spiritual experience during your life. And because of the feeling of that experience, whatever it is, it feels like God. It feels powerful. And you say, that is God. But the problem with that is that people have different experiences, right? So one person has experience A, another person has experience B, and both say that the experience is God, and yet they are different. So what exactly is this God again? It kind of becomes very hard to actually pinpoint it and kind of get down to the understanding of what this idea of God is. So it is problematic. When I hear that people say they are devoted to God, I find it very problematic and very difficult. Basically, what it means is that you are imagining something. It's a fantasy. It's a make-believe. It's something you build up in your own mind. It's a concept that you build up for yourself. And that is what you believe in. So you're devoted to something basically imaginary. And the danger with that is that it may work for a while if you are able to build up a beautiful imagination or fantasy in your mind. It may work for a while. But then sooner or later, you realize that this just is a mirage. It's a fantasy. It's something I made up for myself. You come to some understanding or some realization, or you become disaffected with that particular philosophy like the person I was talking about. And then when this whole thing falls apart, then, of course, you are left with nothing. And the devotion you had before and the meditation, everything falls apart. And this is because, basically, from a Buddhist point of view, the idea is you start off with wrong view, right? And if you start off with a wrong view, you start off with a wrong idea of reality, there's always a chance that the whole thing will fall apart sooner or later. That is the problem with wrong view. When you start off with a wrong view and you act in accordance with that mistaken idea of reality, then it's very likely that your actions and whatever follows from that also will not accord with reality. So you're going in the wrong way, and eventually it will lead to suffering, to problems, and all other kind of things for yourself. And this is the problem with wrong view. That is the first thing I wanted to say. Just this idea of devotion to God, it may seem right, but actually it can be very dangerous because it can lead you down the garden path, take you in the wrong direction, basically. This is just speaking from a Buddhist point of view, of course. So what about Buddhism then? What about devotion in Buddhism? How important is it? How can we actually bring that into the Buddhist practice? And to get a kind of a handle on this, get a grasp on the idea of the importance of devotion in Buddhism, one of the great things is to actually understand the psychology of meditation. What is meditation all about? How does it work? How do you experience meditation? If meditation really works, what we did tonight was kind of very basic meditation, which also is very important, of course. But when meditation really takes off, what does it feel like? How do you experience that meditation? And this is one of the standard discourses, the suttas you find given by the Buddha. He talks about this in many different places, how meditation is experienced. And what he says, and this is very, very interesting and very important, because this is how, it's like a guide, right, a map of how we're supposed to, meditation is supposed to happen. And what he says is that you start off with virtue, right? And from virtue, you then experience a freedom from remorse. From that freedom from remorse, you feel gladness. From the gladness comes joy. From the joy comes tranquility, right? Tranquility is one of those beautiful things when everything becomes very peaceful and beautiful and calm. And from that tranquility comes happiness. It's a very profound happiness that comes when everything becomes very peaceful and beautiful. And from that happiness comes the samadhi, the stillness of the mind, which is so powerful and is one of the primary goals of meditation practice. So if you listen to that, if you listen to that sequence of things, right, what the striking thing about that is that it's all about happiness. It's all about joy. Meditation is all about happiness all the way through. Gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and then stillness of the mind towards the end. And it starts off with virtue and goes all the way through that. And there's something very beautiful and very noble about that, this idea that meditation practice is all about joy and happiness. A very beautiful message. And it's a message that we can all relate to. When we do a bit of practice ourselves, we can start to see that this is how the mind actually moves as you quieten down, as you become peaceful. And it's one of the wonders, in my opinion, of the Buddha's teachings, is this idea, this emphasis that it's all about happiness, all about some kind of positive feeling, some kind of feeling of well-being. One of the great suttas as well, somewhere else in the suttas, the Buddha talks, has a conversation with the Jains. You may have heard about the Jains. The Jains were this really tough religion at the time of the Buddha, and they still exist to the present day. And the Jain monastics, they were both monks and nuns, certainly at the time of the Buddha, they still are today. They would do all these austerities, incredible austerities, and where they would, you know, stand on one leg for 10 years and lie down on the nail of beds. That's no joke. These people existed already at the time of the Buddha. And the idea was, and this is when the Buddha had a discussion with the Jains. The Buddha would ask them, well, why are you doing this? This doesn't make any sense. And they would say that happiness is to be gained through pain, right? If you have pain, then you will get happiness. That was kind of the Jain idea. And this is an idea which I think is very common in human beings. Many of us think that if we no pain, no gain, right? This is kind of the standard way of looking at the world. The Buddha then comes around and he says, no, it isn't like that. It's not that happiness is to be gained by pain. He says happiness is to be gained through happiness, right? It's a completely different way of looking at the world, and it's a completely different way from how many people, and this is not theoretical, many people in the present day, they practice this path of pain because that will eventually reap some kind of happiness for you. But the Buddha says it's the other way around, and the whole psychology of meditation is about happiness. Isn't that a wonderful message? Isn't that kind of exactly what we want? Is anybody here who doesn't want to be happy? It's hard to imagine, isn't it? Please give me some more depression and sorrow. It doesn't work like that. We want to be happy. So this is the message. And then, of course, this happiness and joy, this is emotional stuff, right? These are emotional qualities. So the emotional side is a very important side of the Buddhist practice. You have to kind of get your emotions involved. And if the emotions don't really arise, then it becomes, the path doesn't really take that direction that the Buddha was talking about. Now, one way of getting those emotions going is precisely through devotion, right? Devotion is one of the ways of getting these emotions started on the Buddhist path. And this is actually one of the, I think, very important aspects of the Buddha's teachings, is this very thing about how do we get that process started? How do we get the process of happiness going in the first place? This is a very important part of the teachings. When you look at what I was saying just before, I said it starts off with virtue, right? Sila is the word in Pali. It starts off with virtue, and then the happiness comes. So one way of getting these emotions started is just by being virtuous, just by being kind. And when we talk about virtue in Buddhism, always we're not just talking about not doing the bad stuff, we're talking about also doing the good stuff. This is kind of the broader idea of virtue that we have in the Buddhist teachings. Alternatively, the Buddha also says that another way of giving rise to these emotional states is by generosity. So you are generous. It's almost like part of virtue again, right? Generosity, when you are kind, when you give of yourself. I'm sure many of you have experienced that in your life, when sometimes you feel like your heart opens up and you just want to give to other people. You know that feeling when everything just opens up and you just want to have this endless feeling of giving to others? Now, what does that What does that feel like? It feels very beautiful, right? It feels very pleasant, very nice. And it's part of that joy which drives you on the Buddhist path. So generosity, when it's developed in the right way, also has this power to kind of push you and create the foundation for this meditation practice. But virtue can seem perhaps still a bit dry. It doesn't have to be at all. It depends how you practice it. But there is another way, and this is the third way, and this is the way of devotion in Buddhism. And the way of devotion in Buddhism is a bit different from the way it is in other religions. The way of devotion in Buddhism is the devotion towards three things. And that, of course, is the devotion towards the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, right? This is where devotion is found in the Buddha's teachings. So there is a devotion. So the question then is, if there is this devotion, then how do we actually do that? How do we create that so it actually becomes a powerful force in our meditation practice? So this is where we have to look for devotion. So how do we, let's take the Buddha, how do we think about the Buddha in such a way that it gives rise to a sense of joy when you think about the Buddha? Now, this is not always easy, right? The Buddha seems very remote, 2,500 years ago, in a very different culture. You know, it's sometimes a bit difficult to make that connection with the Buddha. So how do we do that? Now, the first thing we have to be careful of is not to fall in the same trap I was talking about before. And that is the trap of creating a god out of the Buddha, right? Then we fall into the same thing that we were talking about before, where this Hindu person was devoted to God, doesn't really know what it is, and now we're creating a god out of the Buddha, and we're falling into the same problem. It is actually a serious problem in the Buddhist teachings, this idea of creating a god out of the Buddha. This is very common. If you travel around the world and you see how many Buddhists actually practice the Buddha's teachings, it's very often very similar to the way they treat the Buddha is often very similar to the way a Christian might think about God, right? You pray to the Buddha, you say, you know, I would like, you know, this would be come in handy if you could help me with this, please, or whatever it is. Or any other way, you pray to the Buddha as if the Buddha can somehow kind of interact with you and, you know, sort of change your fortune or whatever it is. Now this is a very, very real problem in the world. And of course, it is very different from the way the Buddha is portrayed and talked about in the early suttas. The way the Buddha speaks about himself is very different. And I think it is a very dangerous trap, and I think it can happen to anyone. It's not just because you come from a Buddhist culture. It can happen to anyone that this image of the Buddha kind of arises. The Buddha is like a god. It's so awe-inspiring that you don't really know how to deal with the Buddha. But there's a big danger there, and the danger is that the Buddha becomes so remote and so different from us and so alien that you can't really relate to the Buddha or the Buddha's life anymore. It becomes impossible to have any relationship with the Buddha, so to speak. And when you read the suttas, when you read the word of the Buddha, one thing that he very often does is that he talks about his own life, right? He tells you how he practiced. He tells you what he did to achieve his insights and his deep meditations and his understanding of the world. And of course, when he tells you what he did, the purpose of that is not just theory, is not just kind of, you know, I'm going to tell you a nice story. That's not really the purpose. The purpose is to inspire you, right? The Buddha is saying, I did these things. This is how I practiced. You should do the same, right? He goes into great detail sometimes. Sometimes into kind of small little things. Say how he was in the, he talks about how he was in the forest by himself, and he was frightened, right? Because at night in the forest, completely by yourself, and you hear little sounds. You sort of thinking what they are. You know, what are these sounds about? This is, I'm sure all of you would know what I'm talking about, right? If you're in a completely dark place by yourself, there's nobody around, and you hear a strange sound, it's very easy to become suspicious that something is more dangerous or whatever. And the Buddha has exactly the same experience, right? Exactly the same thing, yeah. So by seeing, by understanding the Buddha as a human being, as one of us, not as a deity, we can relate to the Buddha's life. We can relate to how he practiced. We can relate to who he was. And then we can follow in his footsteps. And we can take the Buddha as an example. Instead of just worshipping the Buddha as some kind of foreign, strange thing far away, we actually use his life as an example instead. And that is a much more powerful thing to do than to act to worship him as something completely different from us. And there's many, many things in the suttas whereby you can relate to the Buddha very easily, and you can see his humanity. You know, he had a son, for example. He talks about his own defilements, right? He talked about his own defilements of mind before he became enlightened. He talks about having wrong view, just like, you know, everybody else. He had wrong view before he kind of got on the right track and started understanding how to use his mind properly. So all of these things brings out the humanity of the Buddha. He's one of us in a way. So that is the one side of the story. So this is one thing. But of course, one has to be careful not to kind of bring this too far down one way. If you make the Buddha into just exactly one of us, then there's nothing much more to be devoted to, right? Obviously, the Buddha was more than just an ordinary human. It was something more. He wasn't just a human. He was human, but he was a human who had taken the human potential to its limit. And that is the power of the Buddha. So you have to understand the Buddha in the right way, not to take him too far in the way of being a god, but also not take him too far in the way of being just an ordinary human. He is something else. He is a human, but he's a human who has reached the absolute highest potential that is possible for humanity. And this is where you start to find the real Buddha, the Buddha who can be you can be devoted to because of his special qualities. So what are the qualities of the Buddha? What are the ways of thinking about the Buddha? And the way that I like to think about the Buddha, I always like to think about two qualities, and these are the qualities of wisdom and compassion. So what does it mean that the Buddha is wise, for example? And these are the things that you can make up for yourself. When you start reading the life of the Buddha, you will see that there are certain qualities, and then you will be inspired by certain things, and you reflect on that, and that will be your Buddha, so to speak, right? Even though the Buddha was a historical personality, he's also a little bit a matter of imagination. You have to imagine him as well. So he's closer to reality than perhaps a god, but there's still some degree of imagination there. So wisdom of the Buddha, what does it mean to be wise, right? What does it mean to be wise? You have an intuition about that. And to me, what it means to be wise, and the way it is also explained in the suttas themselves, is that you have a full understanding of the human condition. You know what the human condition is like, all the way to the root, all the way to the bottom, right? It means that you understand human aspiration, you understand human suffering, you understand human happiness, you understand what we all are here for, you understand basically what you understand is the meaning of life. That is what it is about, to fully understand the human condition. And that is what the Buddha understood. He understood the meaning of life. And of course, the meaning of life, if you look at what drives us as human beings, what actually is important to us, everything we do is somehow guided. We want to move towards more happiness, more well-being, more peace, more of all these good qualities. And we want to move away from the bad qualities, right? Almost everything we do is somehow geared towards that. So if you find a solution to that, if you find, this is what the Buddha said he did, if you find a solution whereby you find, optimize all those good qualities and reduce or even annul, even eliminate completely all the bad ones, then you have found the answer to the meaning of life. The thing that we're all striving for, the thing that we all want, he has found the answer to that. And this is what is meant by the highest wisdom, right? Somebody has understood the human condition all the way to the core, understood what we actually want as human beings, and understood the way of how we can achieve that. And isn't that worthy of devotion? If somebody has that, isn't this the kind of thing which is worthy of? If somebody has the key to life to you, and they can give you that key, isn't that person worthy of tremendous respect and devotion? It's a very, very powerful thing. If you think about the kind of people in the world that are respected, they're usually people who have something that they can give to somebody else. Like a teacher, for example, if somebody has something that they can teach you, and that's why you respect them to some extent. But here is someone who is the highest possible teacher, who has the most profound and most useful of all teachings. So that person must surely be worthy of the highest respect and the highest devotion. So this is how you start to get your mind around how the Buddha actually can be regarded, and how you can feel the sense of devotion towards this historical person who existed about 2,400 years ago. And of course, here you can also start to see how the Buddha is different from a god. Is different because the Buddha, we actually know quite a few things about this person, this Buddha. We can tell quite a few things about him. It's not just a figment of the imagination. It's something very real. And not only that, we know things. The Buddha very clearly said that he understood the human condition to its core. But if you ask what a god is in any religion, whether they created the universe or not, or whatever it is, there is no such... you don't find that kind of expression that they understand the human condition to its core. And from a Buddhist point of view, this is kind of the crux or the whole point here, is that the Buddha is actually higher than these gods, right? He's more, because he has understood something even more profound, even more important for us than any of these other gods might have understood. So he's even higher, even though he's human in one sense. He's actually higher than these gods that we often talk about in whatever religion, even in Buddhism. And that is kind of astonishing. He's human, but he's still more, and still even more worthy of devotion. So that is the first aspect of the Buddha, the idea that he is the wisdom aspect. And the second aspect is the idea of compassion, which also is a very beautiful thing here. And this comes from the idea that the Buddha, after his awakening, he of course was, he had finished kind of his, he didn't have anything more to do in this world, right? He had understood the world as it actually is. And as far as the Buddha was concerned, he might as well pass away and he would have been happy, and there would have been no more trouble for him. But instead of doing that, even though he was perfectly happy and content, he decided, let me instead go out. I have found the solution to the meaning of life. Maybe I should teach that to others so they also can find this release from suffering and movement towards happiness. Right? And this is the only motivation for the Buddha to live on. He doesn't have any other motivation at all. Compassion is the only thing. So isn't that another remarkable thing, this idea that somebody goes into the world and they live on for another 45 years. They have no self-interest, no vested interest for themselves whatsoever. They have finished what they have to do, and yet they live on for another 45 years just to give to others, because they understand that they have found something that is useful to everybody else. It's like pure compassion. The only motivation, the only driving force in the Buddha is compassion for others. Right? It's almost like he's made of compassion, right? This is kind of all it is. Or he's made of wisdom and compassion. So again, everything he does, everything he says, is motivated by this one thing, this kindness and this hope and this idea that I will help others to overcome their troubles in life and move them towards more happiness. So this is how I like to think about the Buddha. And when you think about the Buddha in this way, you start to kind of materialize something. You start to become more clear what the Buddha is all about. And then you can start to get a sense of maybe joy even when you think about this being. But still, it's a bit abstract, because still it is a long way in the past. So sometimes what you can do to help that kind of process is to think about somebody in the present day and age, somebody you really respect, somebody with marvelous spiritual qualities, right? Take somebody like Gandhi. Gandhi is a great example. So Gandhi, he's also from India, so that might kind of be a little bit helpful. So here is Gandhi. And what is it about Gandhi which is so marvelous? Well, here is this man, right, who wants to fight for independence from the colonial powers in India, right? And he does that with such incredible integrity and principles over decade after decade, year after year, going on and on and on, always non-violence, always coming from a sense of not wanting to harm anyone, right? This is kind of the thing which moves you when you think about somebody like Gandhi, somebody who's incredibly principled, incredibly, who does things. He does what is, you know, he does has a big agenda to getting the British out of India, but he does it in a very principled way. So that is one way. When you think about You think about the highest qualities that are possible in humanity, whether it's Gandhi or somebody else. It kind of starts you on the way to understanding what the Buddha is. The Buddha, of course, is much more than that, but it gives you some sense of what the Buddha is by thinking of these spiritual qualities in existing beings here and now. Remember, Ajahn Brahm told me another story. This was a story of a woman he met in, I think, here in Australia, and she was from Eastern Europe, and she had been a prisoner in Eastern Europe before the Iron Curtain fell down, right, while the Cold War was still in progress. And she had been a prisoner, political prisoner at that time. And Ajahn Brahm had asked her, well, don't you feel embittered by having to sit, by just, you know, doing what is right, having done what is, you know, lived a life of integrity? Don't you feel embittered that people imprisoned you for doing what is right and doing what is good? And she said, no, because if I had allowed myself to become bitter because of this, then they would have won over me. That is how they would have won. But by keeping my integrity and keeping my sense of what is right and what is good, that is how I could kind of sustain myself through those years in prison. Right? It's a bit like Nelson Mandela as well, similar kind of idea. These beautiful qualities that people sometimes have, even in hardship, and they pull through in this way, and these kind of things are so inspiring in the world. And just by reflecting on this, it gives you a certain idea who the Buddha was. And of course, you can also think of other people, spiritual practitioners, teachers you may have had in Buddhism or whatever, and all of these things that lead you in the same idea. And then you multiply that a little bit, and you extrapolate a little bit, and then you start to get some idea of who the Buddha was as a person. Okay, so that is the Buddha, and just a little bit of help on how to kind of develop that sense of respect and devotion towards this historical personality here. Then there is also the Dhamma, right? The Buddha says you don't have to think about the Buddha. You can think about the Dhamma as well. It's another way of creating joy in your meditation practice, devotion to the Dhamma. So how do we create devotion to the Dhamma? The Dhamma is just a teaching, right? It's a teaching that the Buddha gave. And it's a teaching that leads to all these beautiful things. This is what I was talking about just before, this beautiful teaching about how when you meditate properly, all you do is you go through stage after stage of happiness, one more profound than the other. And this is what the Dhamma does, right? It takes you to all these things that you have ever wanted in life. And actually, it gives you much more than you ever wanted, because it's much more profound than probably anything you can even imagine, right? That's what the Dhamma does. It drives you. It's this wonderful teaching that is the answer to every want that you ever had in your life. But a real answer, a profound answer, not some kind of shallow answer to these things. So it is an experiential thing. It's how we experience the world. That is what the Dhamma is all about. And there's another nice sutta, another nice discourse of the Buddha. And just to show you the difference here between the Dhamma and the worldly things. This is one of the things that this discourse does. And this is a monk, his name was Samidhi at the time of the Buddha, and he is somewhere, and while he is at this place, this deva, this god, comes down to him, right? This kind of tempter figure. And this god comes down to him, apparently it's a female god, probably extraordinarily beautiful and all this, and comes down to him. And what this god says to him, she says that, you are still young, monk. You're still kind of, good looking with black hair and all these kind of things. Why on earth have you given up all the pleasures of life to seek this kind of, intangible spiritual things? Because the pleasures of life, they are right here and now. You can get them right away, right? Go and enjoy yourself. Whereas the spiritual things, they are something in the future, something that isn't really tangible, something that isn't right here, right now. And then this monk Samidhi says, and this is the interesting thing, he says that it's not like that at all. It's the other way around. It is the happinesses of the world, the sensual pleasures of the world, that is what is always in the future. That is what actually is intangible. And it is the spiritual qualities, the Dhamma, which is tangible and visible right here, right now. Right? That's what he says. So what do you think? Does that make any sense? It's because often it feels like that, right? This, you can see where that day that God is coming from, because it feels like the spiritual things are often in the future, whereas the happinesses of the world, they're right here, right now. So what does this monk mean by actually it is the opposite? What does it mean by that? And what it means is that the sensual pleasures or the pleasures of the world, they're always related to craving. There's always craving there. There's always something that we're moving towards. There's always something we're never really satisfied, right? We're always moving towards something. There's always something in the future. Craving is always about the future. Desire is always about the future. So this is the thing about the worldly pleasures. They are actually about the future. And even when you get a bit satisfied, you have a nice meal, it's not really a real profound sense of satisfaction. It's a fairly shallow thing. And it doesn't take long before the craving re-arises again and it goes to a different object. Or you may even have craving right there, right then for something else. Or you feel a bit kind of hollow because the satisfaction isn't that deep, whatever it is. So sensual pleasures, the pleasures of the world, they are what actually are about the future. Craving, by its very definition, is something about the future. But spiritual happiness, why is that about the here and now? Well, one way the Buddha describes the idea of the Dhamma being visible here and now, he says it's visible here and now because we can understand our current situation, our defilements right here, right now. If you look inside your mind, look inside your heart, you can see whether there's a defilement there or not. You can see whether you feel happy, whether it's free from that defilement or not. And because you can see that, you can do something about it right here, right now. Now, if you have the tools, if you understand the teachings of the Buddha and you start to feel a bit angry and you're aware of that, this is what the Buddha means by the Dhamma is visible. You feel the anger, ooh, it might be coming. Then you apply the Dhamma of the Buddha and the anger disappears, or the negativity, whatever it is, disappears, right? So, and what happens when you do that is that you feel a sense of satisfaction, you feel a sense of peace inside of you. So by understanding the defilements right here, right now, by understanding the problems in the mind right here, right now, you can do something about it. And when every time you do something about it, because craving is about the future, anger is often about the past. They did this, they did that. The moment you do something about it, you feel a sense of peace. You feel a sense of satisfaction. You feel a sense of completion. You feel a sense of contentment, right? All these good things that you want, all these good things that you actually you are searching for all the time, they come at the moment when you are able to let go of that defilement of the mind. And that is how you see the Dhamma right here, right now. You can see where this is going. And of course, the more of those defilements you abandon, the more peaceful you feel. You can see how the Dhamma works right here in this present moment. So watch that. Watch your mind. See what happens. Every time you abandon a desire, every time you abandon an anger or irritation, whatever it is, see what happens to you. And you will see that the fulfillment suddenly comes. The craving tells you, when I do this, when I get A, when I pursue this kind of pleasure, whatever, when I get to that point, then I will feel fulfilled. The answer is no. The fulfillment comes when you let go of that craving in the here and now, because you understand that it drives you away from happiness. That's when you feel fulfilled. That's when you feel complete. And that's when you feel this deep sense of contentment that otherwise you cannot have. So this is what the Dhamma is about, right? This is this teaching, this beautiful teaching of the Buddha, which drives you towards contentment, drives you towards happiness, gives you a way of looking at the world, which is almost the exact opposite of what how we normally think about the world. So that's the Dhamma. This is just ways that I sometimes like to reflect, right? Again, there's many ways of reflecting about this, but the point is to give rise to something which feels powerful and feels joyful, and you can feel devoted to the Dhamma in that way. And the last thing, just very briefly, is of course the Sangha. And the Sangha is essentially, it is the living expression of the Buddha's teaching, right? The Sangha here and now, whatever person has practice these teachings in such a way that you can tell by the character, tell by who they are, that they have received the benefits of these teachings. So when you see a person like that, That is then what you are devoted to. Every time you see somebody who is different, who has some qualities that you think, wow, that's very, very powerful and very rare in the world to find these kind of qualities, that is when you have a sense of devotion to the Sangha. The Buddha says somewhere, even just seeing an arahant in the world, just seeing an arahant is a tremendous blessing. Because when you see somebody who is fully awakened, somebody has understood these teachings, when you look carefully, you will see something which is very, very different from what you normally see in the world. You see somebody without craving. You see somebody who is driven by compassion and kindness. Somebody who never gets angry. Somebody who always understands. Somebody who always has time, right? Somebody who never rushes around. There's something when you see a person like that that gives you a sense of hope, right? You see that there's something more in this world. There isn't just the ordinary sufferings and problems of life, all the things that we have to go through. There's something very powerful out there. Something that when you see it in another human being, you realize that you too have that potential. You too can move in that direction and go in the same way. It gives you hope. It gives you inspiration. It gives you the drive to do the same thing for yourself. And this is the power of the reflection on the Sangha. So Sangha is, it's a similar kind of thing as thinking about the Buddha and the Dhamma. So these are just some simple guidelines on how to develop this idea of devotion in Buddhism. I think it is actually very important and very useful. And it brings kind of the emotional side of Buddhism alive. And it brings your emotions also into the practice. It doesn't become too dry anymore, right? So sometimes when you have the time, perhaps sometimes you'd like to read a bit of the word of the Buddha, whatever it is, but if you have the time to reflect a little bit about the meaning of the Buddha, the meaning of the Dhamma, and the meaning of the Sangha, and make that come alive and get some joy out of that, it can end up becoming a very powerful source to support you in your Buddhist practice and certainly in your meditation practice. Okay, so that's it. That's the talk for tonight. Okay, so any questions? Anybody want to say anything here? Everybody very very happy here. Oh, yeah. Good. Chris at the back there. Here. Is there a microphone to be passed around? Or, you have it already. Okay, good.
Bhante, what qualities would you suggest that lay people look for in the Sangha to be used as criteria for worthiness to apply this devotion? You know, you've got monks and you've got monks, as you well know.
Yeah.
What would you advise as the criteria to look for in monks and nuns, which indicate that they are worthy of devotion?
Okay. Well, this is actually answered by the Buddha in the suttas. You know, when you go to a monastic or you go to a... you meet somebody who you think might be spiritually attained or whatever, you meet somebody, the Buddha says that you should actually look for to see whether they have these defilements there or not, whether they have, greed, anger, and delusion are kind of the basic roots of that we talk about in Buddhism. Now, of course, it's not always easy to see these things, as you may know. Particularly things like delusion and greed can be hard to see. Anger probably can be seen sometimes if somebody gets angry. What you can see is the flip side of these things. Because if somebody doesn't have these negative qualities, they will have lots of very good qualities, right? So you don't just focus on the absence of the bad qualities, you focus on the presence also of the good qualities. So have they got the metta? Have they got the loving kindness? Do they have the peace, right? Do they have the energy? Energy is actually a very good way of looking for somebody's spiritual attainment. Somebody who is very highly spiritual, we have lots of energy. And they will have this ability to give all the time, right? Tremendous energy in giving. One of the factors of somebody who is on the path of awakening is that they are incredibly generous. This is one of the things. They are completely open-hearted. They will always want to give. The sense of always wanting to give because they know the power of giving. And their heart is basically completely open. This is one way of looking at it. And of course, their conduct, their virtue should be very, very powerful. That is, of course, another factor. So these are the good things to look for. Sometimes it can be very hard to judge, right? Sometimes we just don't know. But what we should, I think, it's sometimes people are too afraid of making even basic judgments, and that is also no good. Sometimes when you see something which looks suspect, you don't have to make an absolute judgment, but it's good to trust your own ability to understand what's going on. So if you see something that is a bit suspect or looks a bit dodgy, then it's okay to say, okay, I'm having my doubts about this. That's fine, and we should do that. We shouldn't be too afraid of making some basic kind of judgment in that sense. So that, I think, is important. So that is how I would go about it. So, and again, I think one of the principles as well is to be very careful also never to place too much faith in any one particular individual. This is also dangerous. And I have seen this many times in my own life. You see people who have tremendous devotion to one person, and then that person turns out to be dodgy, right? Bad. And they do things, and you get so disillusioned. I mean, if you have tremendous confidence in somebody, really strong faith, very devoted to someone, and then they go and do something which is absolutely crazy, then of course it's a tremendous, incredibly powerful letdown for people, and they often lose their whole faith in Buddhism. I was on the phone with somebody recently who said that their mother had been a disciple of somebody who had disrobed, like somebody had been a monk for 40 years, and then they disrobed, right? And they thought that this monk was an arahant or whatever. And then they disrobe and they go and live with a woman instead. Of course, there is a problem there. It wasn't a real thing. So yes, have some devotion. When you see good qualities, great. But never have too much faith in individuals, because individuals can always let you down. You never know. If you are able to have faith in the Sangha as a whole, in a sense, that if you have seen enough people with good qualities, that you know that the Sangha as a whole is practicing kind of, not as a whole, that there are enough people within the Sangha who practice in the right way, then that is really a better place to have your confidence. And ultimately, if you can bring your confidence back to the Buddha and his teachings, that is probably a safer bet than individuals.
Thank you, Andy.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. Everybody. Yes. Okay.
Arjun, what would be the criteria for wisdom?
The criteria for wisdom?
Yep.
Okay. It's very, very hard to pin it down. But the criteria for wisdom, I think one of the best criteria for wisdom is the depth of your meditation practice, right? So you can actually know how wise you are through the depth of your own meditation practice. Sometimes people think that I'm wise, they read the suttas, they think they have understood what the dependent origination is about and the five aggregates and all these kind of things. But the meditation isn't deep. And if the meditation isn't deep, it shows that the wisdom hasn't really penetrated. It's not really profound. Because what is wisdom? Well, wisdom is, ultimately in Buddhism, wisdom is understanding what we talk about as the three characteristics of existence, right? The three characteristics of existence are impermanence, suffering, and non-self. Now, if you understand suffering, if you understand that the things of the world are suffering and are not worthy of holding on to, it means you can let go of those things. Now, if you can let go of those things, that is precisely what is required for deep meditation. What stops you from meditating deeply is your attachments to sensuality, right? Your attachment to the body. If you can let go of that, then meditation becomes accessible. So wisdom, because it is about understanding the world as it actually is, it enables you to let go of those things that stand in the way of meditation practice. So wisdom must always lead to good meditation. If it doesn't lead to good meditation, it's not real wisdom, it's only superficial. So on the personal level, that is the best way of gauging whether you are very wise or not, how deep your meditation goes. Now, to gauge in somebody else, again, it is not so easy. But again, it comes back to the things we're talking about just now. You have to look at somebody. How much, what do they look like? Do they look like somebody who is peaceful, somebody who is kind, somebody who is virtuous, somebody who is generous, etc.? And if you see those qualities in there, there is a good chance that there will be some wisdom there as well.
Thank you.
Okay. So, anyone else want to say anything here? No? Okay, so, yes, one over here. At the front here, here, all the way to the front.
Buddha, it means like, it's like the lightning of my time, eternity. Eternity.
Yeah. The meaning of the word Buddha is actually awakening. That's what it means. Yeah, awakened. Yes. That's what it means. Yeah. That's the actual meaning of the word. Yeah. So that in itself is quite nice, isn't it? Awakening. The idea of waking up. It's like you've been slightly dreaming, slightly in the fantasy, and then one day, wow, now I understand. Kind of feels nice, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay. So let us, if everybody's happy, then we'll pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Patipanno Bhagavan.